I must discharge. Forgive me. Please, please forgive me. When the prayer was said, he slumped upon the floor and seemed not to have the strength to rise. But he did so, and asked Nyuk-tsin, "Do you know what I must do?" "Yes, doctor. Tomorrow, police." "I must," he replied sorrowfully. "But you can stay here as long as you wish, and all your children," he assured her. "I, Kokua," she said simply. He had to look away from her face as the crushing force of this word struck him, for he knew what it meant. The banishment, the horrors of the leper settlement, the sons lost forever. He thought, "I would not have the courage." Then he recalled that it had been Mun Kai's plan to abandon Nyuk-tsin as soon as they got back to China and to take her children from her, and now she was volunteering to go Kukua with him. Slowly he raised his head and looked at Nyuk-tsin. She was a small Chinese woman, with not much hair, slanted eyes, brown wrinkles about her mouth. But she was his sister, and he stepped forward and kissed her on each cheek, saying, "I should have known that you would go Kukua." He turned away to stanch his tears, and then asked brightly like a minister, "Now, what can we do about the children?" "Tonight I fix one boy here, one boy here, one boy here, all fix." She told him which families would take whom, and when this was explained, she asked, "Tomorrow, police?" "Yes, I must. In God's mercy, I must." "I know, doctor. Long time ago I speak my husband, police go, but we hope." "God will forgive those who hope," the old man said. As soon as he was gone, Mun Kai was out of bed, explosive with energy. "We will run to the hills," he swore. "The police will never find us there." "How will we eat?" Nyuk-tsin pleaded. "We'll take food," Mun Kai explained excitedly. He had visions of a free life in the mountains. He and Nyuk-tsin would work for nobody, and maybe even the sores would go away. "Hurry," he cried. "We must be gone before the police come." Nyuk-tsin looked at her husband with incredulity. How could he hope to lose himself in the hills back of Honolulu when the police would be on his trail within 6 hours, and when every Hawaiian who saw two Chinese struggling through the trails would know they were Maipake? It was ridiculous, insane, as impractical as the reliance upon the quack doctor, and she was about to tell him so. But then she looked in a new way at her quixotic husband, and saw him as a temporary assembly of earth and bone and confused desire and a pigtail and hands that would soon fall apart with leprosy. He was a man who could be very wise and the next minute quite stupid, as now. He was a human being who loved children and old people, but who was often forgetful of those his own age. He was a mercurial gambler charged with hope. He had hoped that the quack doctor could cure him. Now he hoped that somehow the forests would hide him. But above all, he was her man. Even though he was a punti, he had chosen her as his woman, and she loved him more than she loved her own sons. If he had this crazy desire to try his luck once more in the hills, she would go with him, for he was an obstinate man and sometimes a foolish one. But he was a man who deserved to be loved. It was 2 o'clock in the morning when Nyuk-tsin finished hiding in high places anything that might hurt her children. Then she went to each child as he slept on the long polished board and fixed his clothes so that in the morning when the boys were discovered they would be presentable, and she straightened her bed. Then she took her husband's hand and led him out the Whipple Gate and up toward the mountains back of Oahu. She did not depart unnoticed, for Dr. Whipple, unable to sleep, had kept watch on the Chinese quarters, suspecting an attempted flight. But when it eventuated, and he saw the thin little Chinese woman guiding her doomed husband toward the hills, he could not bring himself to stop them or to sound an alarm. and when she carefully returned to close his gate lest his dogs escape, he prayed, "May God have mercy upon those who hope." At first he was inclined to go down and bring the Chinese babies into the house, but he thought, "That might arouse somebody. Anyway, I'm sure Nyuk-tsin left them in good condition." So he sat by the window, guarding the house where the babies slept. But after a while, his New England conscience, undaunted by 48 years in the tropics, made him reason, "The children must not be left in that contaminated house another minute. Rescue now might save them from the disease, whereas an hour's delay might give it to them." So in the darkness before dawn, he led his wife to the Chinese house, gently wakened the children so as not to frighten them, undressed them so that not a shred of their old garments came with them, and carried them into the Whipple home. When this was done, Dr. Whipple studied his watch and thought, "Nyuk-tsin and her man have had 2 hours' lead. It will be all right to call the policeman." And he sent a servant after the officials. When they arrived, he reported, "Munkai has leprosy. We must burn the house and everything in it." And with his own matches, he ignited both the Chinese house and the cooking shed. Then, pointing to the Nuuanu Valley, he said, "I think they headed for those hills." Throughout the morning, he expected the police to appear with the two Chinese, but their capture was delayed. The afternoon also passed, and so did the evening, without the Whipple servants being apprehended. This seemed strange to the doctor, and early next morning he inquired of the police what had happened. "There's no trace of them," the officers explained. "I'm sure they went up the Nuuanu," Dr. Whipple assured them. "If they did, they vanished," the police replied. An ugly thought came to the doctor, and he asked, "Did you look at the foot of the pali?" "We thought of suicide," the police assured him, "and we studied the pali rocks, but they didn't jump." Day by day, the mystery deepened. Nyuk-tsin and her dream-spinning husband had accomplished the miracle Munkai had relied upon. They had fled to the mountains and had somehow disappeared. Fortunately, the quack herbalist and his two spies had had the good luck to report Nyuk-tsin's suspicious behavior to the police before Dr. Whipple did. "We are sure she is hiding her husband, who is my Paki." So they got their reward, and the herbalist often pointed out to his friends, "If I had waited till next morning, the leper would have been gone, and I would have received nothing. This proves that it is always best to perform your duty promptly, and let the sluggards lie abed lazily till the next convenient day." At the end of a week, the police came again to Dr. Whipple and confessed, "We've been to every grass house between here and the other seacoast. No Chinese. We've been wondering if your servants could have doubled back and gone into hiding somewhere right around here. You spoke of arrangements made by the woman to give her children away. Which families did she choose?" A minute search of those premises also failed to reveal the fugitives. So the police said, "We are faced by a mystery. Somehow Nyuk-tsin and her husband have made themselves invisible." And so far as active energy was concerned, the official search for the leper ended. On the night that Nyuk-tsin led her husband through the Whipple Gate and then turned back to close it lest the dogs escape, she walked rapidly toward the mountains, and as she stepped boldly forth, Munkai, trailing a few paces behind, could not help seeing her big, unbound feet, and he thought, "On a night like this, it's all right for a woman to have such feet." But reflection on this ancient problem that separated the Punti and the Hakka served to remind him of the mournful fact that he would never again see his village, and he grew disconsolate and lost his optimism, and said, "It will soon be morning, and they will find us." His wife, who originally had advised against this ridiculous attempt to escape, now became the one who urged her husband on, assuring him, "If we can get even to the lower hills before dawn, we will be safe." And she began to formulate stratagems, one of which she put into effect as dawn broke. We will hide beneath those thickets, she said, close to the road where no one will look. All day? Her irresolute husband asked. Yes. There's a trickle of water running through, and I have some balls of cold rice. They approached the thicket from a roundabout way so as not to leave footprints leading into it, and when daylight brought travelers to the road, none saw the leper and his kokua. Nor did the police when they hurried past, nor did the children on their way to school. All day, stout-hearted Nyuk-tsin kept her man hidden, and for long periods they slept. But when Mun-kai was sleeping and his wife was awake, she was distraught by the manner in which her man shivered, for leprosy seemed to be accompanied by a slow fever that kept an infected man forever cold and stricken with trembling. That night, Nyuk-tsin wakened her husband, counted her rice balls, and started on up the mountainside. She did not know where she was going, for she was impelled by only one driving consideration. The longer they evaded the police, the longer they were free, and such a simple doctrine anyone could understand. They grew hungry, cold, and weak, but she drove them both on, and in this manner they escaped capture for 3 days, but they approached starvation and exhaustion. I have no more strength to walk, the sick man protested. I will lend you my shoulders, Nyuk-tsin replied. And that night, with Mun-kai hanging on to his wife's back, but using his own sick legs to walk whenever he could, they made some progress toward their unknown goal. But it was cruelly evident that this was the last night Mun-kai could move. So when morning came, his wife bedded him down in a hidden ravine, washed his face with cold water running out of the hills, and set forth to find some food. That day it rained, and while Nyuk-tsin sloshed through the mountains gathering roots and trying vainly to trap a bird, her afflicted husband shivered on the cold ground while surface water crept in below his shoulders and hips, soon making him wet and colder still. It was a dismal, hungry night, with a handful of roots to chew and not even a remnant of hope to rely upon. And it became Mun-kai's intention, when morning came, to crawl out to the highway and wait until the searching police found him. But Nyuk-tsin had other plans, and in the hour before dawn she told her shivering husband, Wu Chao's father, stay here, and I promise you that I shall return with food and help. She smoothed the damp earth about him, and saw with dismay that it was going to rain again that day, but she told him to be of cheer, for she would soon return. Crawling carefully among the trees parallel to the highway, she looked for narrow trails leading off into the hills, and after a while she came upon one, well trod, and this she followed for several hundred yards, until she came upon a clearing in which an almost collapsed grass shack stood, with a 300-pound Hawaiian woman sitting happily in front. Cautiously but with confidence, Nyuk-tsin walked down the path to greet the huge woman. But before the Chinese maid could speak in explanation of her unexpected appearance in the clearing, the big Hawaiian woman asked, Are you the Chinese who is Maipaki? My husband, hidden in the ravine, is the one, Nyuk-tsin replied in Hawaiian. The big woman began to rock back and forth on her unsteady chair, lamenting, Ao wei, ao wei, it is so terrible, the Maipaki. Then she looked at the Chinese and said, For 3 days the police have been here every day searching for you. Could you please let us have some food? Nyuk-tsin begged. Of course, the big woman cried. We don't have much. Kimo, she called unexpectedly. And from the lowly grass house a big, fat, lazy Hawaiian man appeared, with no shirt and a pair of almost disintegrating sailor's pants held up by a length of rope. He was not shaved or washed, and apparently he had slept in his pants for several months, but he had a huge, amiable, grinning face. What is it, Apakela? He asked, using her biblical name Abigail. The Maipake is hiding in the ravine, Apakela explained. He hasn't eaten for 4 days. We better get him some food, Kimo, the biblical James, replied. and he hurried back into the grass house, and soon reappeared with a tea leaf full of poi, some baked breadfruit, and a few chunks of coconut. "No rice," he joked. "I'll take it to the sick man," Yuk-tsin replied. "I'll go with you," Kimo volunteered. "It isn't necessary," Yuk-tsin protested, for she did not want to involve these kind people with the police. "How are you going to carry him back here?" Kimo demanded. Yuk-tsin could scarcely believe the word she was hearing. Without looking at Kimo, she asked softly, "Then I can hide him here for a few days?" "Of course," Apikela laughed, rocking back and forth. "Those damned police. It's a terrible thing to catch sick men and send them to a lonely island," Kimo agreed. "If a man's going to die, let him die with his friends. He's soon gone, and nobody is poorer." He wrapped up the food and said, "Show me where the poor fellow is." But now Apikela rose and said, "No, Kimo, I'll go. If police are on the road, it'll be better if I'm the one they question, because I can claim I'm on my way to work, and if they come here, it will look less suspicious if you were asleep in the house as usual." Kimo considered this logic for a moment and agreed with his shrewd wife that things would give a better appearance if the day's routine were not broken, so he went back to bed. Fat Apikela marched slowly down the path, and Yuk-tsin kept up with her by creeping through the rainforest. And the two women had progressed only a little way when Apikela stopped, motioned to the Chinese, and said, "It would seem more reasonable if I had two chains of mylay about my neck. Go back and ask Kimo for them." And when the huge woman had placed the spicy mylay leaves about her shoulders, the procession resumed. Her strategy was a good one, for when she reached the highway with Yuk-tsin cowering behind in the forest, police came by on horses and asked, "Have you seen the Maipake Chinese?" "No," she replied blandly. "What are you doing abroad so early, Apikela?" "Gathering mylay vines as usual," she said. They saw the vines and believed. "If you see the Chinese in your clearing, come out to the road and report them." "I will," the gigantic woman agreed, and slowly she moved on down the road. Now Yuk-tsin ran ahead, and it was fortunate that she did so, for when she reached the spot where she had left her husband, she saw that Munkai had disappeared, and she experienced a moment of despair. But she was soon able to pick up his tracks through the muddy leaves, and she guessed that he was headed toward the highway to give himself up. In panic, Yuk-tsin followed his trail, and saw him just as he was about to climb an embankment and cry to passing strangers. Leaping ahead, she dashed up behind him and caught his legs, grappling with him and dragging him back down into the forest. "I have brought you food," she gasped. "Where?" he asked, sure that his wife's empty hands proved the hoax. "There," Yuk-tsin replied. And through the trees that edged the highway she pointed to the figure of a huge woman, rolling and wheezing along in a tent-like brown dress made of Boston fabric. She wore mylay chains about her neck, and an unconcerned, happy smile upon her enormous brown face. "Who's that?" Munkai whispered. "Apikela," his wife replied, and darted out to haul the Hawaiian mylay gatherer into the forest. The big woman looked at the leper's sad condition, and tears came into her eyes. Handing Yuk-tsin the bundle of food, she gathered the scrawny Chinese to her capacious bosom and whispered, "We will take care of you." For nearly a month, Apikela and her slothful husband Kimo sequestered the Chinese, sharing with them their meager supplies of food. Because they were now four to feed, Apikela had to go each day into the forest to gather mylay, which her husband prepared for market, by skillfully slitting the bark, cutting out the pithy core, and leaving a fragrant, supple vine that could be woven into leis. Periodically, he lugged the mylay into Honolulu, peddling it among the flower merchants. With the money thus gained, he would shoot a few games of pool, buy some breadfruit, a little pork, and some rice. Since Hawaiians rarely ate rice, this purchase occasioned comment, which Kimo rebuffed by observing, "I'm switching to rice, so I'll be smart like a pake." Once, when big, lazy Kimo ambled home with rice, Nyuk-tsin bit her lip and asked, "Why do you do this for us, Kimo?" And Apikela interrupted, saying, "When we were children, going to the church, we were often told of how Jesus loved the lepers, and it was a test of all good men how they treated those who were sick. And no leper ever came to Jesus without receiving aid, and no leper will come to the house of Kimo and Apikela to be turned away." "How much longer can we hide here?" Nyuk-tsin asked. "Until the man dies," Apikela said resolutely. And they lived like this for another week. And then a spy in a Honolulu store put two and two together, reasoning, "Kimo never before sold such amounts of maile, and he never bought rice either. It is Kimo who is hiding the Maipake Chinese." And this man hurried to the police and told them, "I am certain that Kimo and Apikela, in the clearing up toward the Pali, are hiding the Maipake." So the spy got a good reward for his ability to think cleverly. And that afternoon, the police crept in upon the clearing. When they charged out, Nyuk-tsin grabbed a frail stick and tried desperately to fight them off, and big Apikela tried to wrestle with them, and Kimo shouted, "Who was the evil man who betrayed us?" But weak and shivering Mun Kai walked out of the little near-collapsing grass shack and gave himself up. The police were so pleased with having taken the fugitives that they started immediately to hustle them away. But Nyuk-tsin cried in Hawaiian, "Let us at least thank these good people." But she was not allowed this courtesy, and as she was dragged down the path and onto the highway, she looked back and saw the two enormous Hawaiians weeping as their friends were hauled into final custody. When Dr. Whipple heard that his Chinese servants had been captured, he hurried to the leper station, where the afflicted were assembled for shipment to their outcast island, and sought out Nyuk-tsin and her husband. "I wish you had escaped," he told them in Hawaiian. "I am sorry to see you here." "Have you taken the children to their homes?" Nyuk-tsin asked. "Are you determined to be a kokua?" Whipple countered. "Yes." "You're free to leave here if you wish, until the boat sails." He drove her to his home and showed her the four children, fat and happy in American clothes. She started to laugh and said, "They don't look like Chinese." She gathered them up and said that she would walk with them to their new homes. But Dr. Whipple piled them into his carriage, and they started forth on their unpleasant mission. At the first house, Apunti's, she delivered a son and said, "Bring him up to be a good man." The Punti replied, "It will be difficult, but we'll try." At the second house, Ahaha's, she said, "Teach him to speak all the languages." And the Haha grudgingly took the child. At the third, another Punti's, she begged, "Bring him up to honor his father." And at the last house, another Haha's, she warned again, "Teach him to speak all the languages." Then she asked the doctor to drive her to the Hewlett home, and there she found the cook and his wife and spoke of the child that was not yet born. And she said to these Punti, "You are to keep this child as your own. Give it your name. Teach it to revere you as its just parents." "When will the child get here?" the people asked. "As soon as a ship leaves from the leper island," Nyuk-tsin replied. And the intended parents shivered with apprehension. On the way back to the quarantine station, Dr. Whipple drove a short distance up Nu'uanu Valley to the land which he had given Nyuk-tsin. Placing stones at the corners of a 7-acre field, he assured her, "Mrs. Key, I have entered this plot at the land court and paid taxes on it. When your husband dies, because he can't live much longer, you come back here and start a little garden and get your children back with you.